everybody, and thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks on 1-2 Radio, changing the way we think about and experience our world. And I am thrilled to have a guest on today's show. I mean, you know, with COVID, it's not like we have to not have guests, but it feels like just a number of things have happened. And so I had Susan a few weeks ago, but I just haven't had Bruce Rawls on the show forever. I was even telling him before the show, I couldn't even remember the last time he was actually on the show with me. So I am thrilled to have Bruce back. And there again, I mean, it's stuff with me, it's stuff with Bruce, but mostly me and my schedule and just trying to get things done. So Bruce, thank you so much for joining me again today.
Thank you for having me on your show again, C.A. Always enjoy conversations very much.
Yeah, and for those of you who may not remember Bruce, because it's been a while, he is a web designer and an avid student and teacher of A Course in Miracles. And he always has a very fun kind of perspective on the course. And one of the things we had talked about is I told him how much I was really getting into this workshop by Ken Wapnick called Living in the World, Prison or Classroom. And so he said, oh, great topic. And so he decided that he would kind of join in on that. And I know he's been able to listen to a few of the shows. But, and by the way, Bruce, last week in the chat room, at least one person, maybe a couple of people said, you know, I think this is the best workshop we've listened to of Ken's. And I mean, I'm feeling that same way. I don't know why, but I'm really resonating with this particular workshop of his.
It's a really good one, isn't it? Yeah.
It is, and like so many of the analogies, like one of the analogies that literally has just so stayed with me is he, on one of the shows, or one of the shows, one of the parts of the workshop, and I think, by the way, it was a weekend workshop, and of course we listened to it in just excerpts on the show, but we've already listened to 5 different weeks, but he gave an analogy. He talked about the time that Orson Welles did the War of the Worlds, you know, dramatization. Now, I don't even remember. Was that in the late 20s or was it the 30s? Do you remember when he did that?
Somewhere in that era, yeah. It's been, you know, a better part of a century for sure.
Yeah.
How much exactly? I'd have to Google it or something. But, yeah, I recall that mention in that talk with Ken and you know, the salient point being that some of us – you know, metaphorically jumped in after the opening announcement that said, "Oh, this is just a fantasy, and it's made, you know," and of course the implication is, it's made to sound really real and believable, and the people that tuned in, and I guess historically, there were several people that tuned in after the opening announcement that this was a dramatization, a story, basically. They missed that, and they thought it was a legitimate news update, and there were some serious consequences as a result of that.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, it was interesting, I mean, not to get too much into the War of the Worlds, but, you know, people in that day and age, there was no television, so they were used to tuning in to radio dramatizations and literally people reading stories or, you know, almost like plays that were being done on the radio. So there is a part of me that kind of wonders that people weren't kind of, oh, well, is this just a dramatization? But that was obviously not true. The people that did not tune in at the beginning did not hear the announcement. And of course, the way they set it up, you know, we're interrupting this show to announce, you know, Martians have invaded New Jersey or whatever it was.
Right.
And like you say, there were far-reaching consequences. And, you know, is there a person ever who somehow hasn't heard about that at some time or another in their lives? Well, obviously, we weren't around when it happened, but we always hear about it.
Yeah.
You know, it was a big deal. And when Ken said, you know what? We're pretty much the same way. It's like we didn't hear the announcement that it's like, okay, by the way, guys, everything you're about to experience is made up. Don't take it seriously. Don't react to it. It's like, oh my God, I said, that is exactly what it feels like.
Yep. And I think even more to the point, and I think Ken mentioned this in his commentary, it's not so much that we didn't hear it. It's just we kind of, you know, covered our ears and went la 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 la.
Right, or we forget it.
We intentionally went out of our way to forget that opening announcement, which is nothing happened. You know,
mm-hmm.
the perfect oneness that we thought we shattered, you know, is still fine and well, thank you, and completely intact, and has no no record of any damage. So not to worry, right?
Yes. And so I thought that was so good for an analogy.
Oh,
and like
great.
I said, it's really helping me because almost every morning I go, okay, remember the announcement. Everything you're about to experience is made up. Can you remember that for 5 minutes?
Yeah, you know, actually, I'm remembering in a creative writing class in high school, in fact, I hadn't thought about this for some time. I wrote a little story about childbirth, actually, and how, you know, this soul decided, okay, it's time to go back again. And, you know, and I made it kind of like a sci-fi thing of, you know, an astronaut strapping himself into a tiny little compartment and then, you know. Out comes the cosmonaut, astronaut, whatever, into this world of, you know, harsh sounds and sights and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, the idea was that, you know, once that was underway, it was assumed that, you know, the forgetfulness would kick in.
Right.
And Ken goes into, you know, some significant detail about, you know, how we successively, you know, burn the bridge in our mind, or the, you know, destroy the upper rungs of the ladder as we climb down it in our minds only, because they're still there. But in a sense, you know, maybe metaphorically, ego's ladder, that the further we go into oblivion, the more we seem like there's no way out. But Holy Spirit says, hey, I've got this other ladder here. climb this up. Nothing's been damaged. You can get right back up with a little practice here.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, Ken goes over the same material all the time, but we need it, obviously. And within this workshop, too, I think one of the first excerpts that we played, he once again said, okay, none of this is true. We made it up, but be normal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to run circles around things going, I deny it, just like you were talking about, putting your fingers in your ear, la, 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 this isn't true, this person isn't sick, I'm not sick, or this isn't happening, you know. That is silliness.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's not real doesn't mean that we're not responding to it, but just learning to respond to it in a different way. And I think that's so important because, I mean, I would be that person who wants to stick my fingers in my ears and say, this isn't real, this isn't real, instead of doing something, you know, about it. You know,
yeah,
like just be a normal person. Like, in fact, I got such a kick out of a woman, and this has stuck with me too. A woman in the workshop said to Ken, you know, that she had a problem with rats. But she went on and on and on and on about all the things that she had done. You know, she had brought in a shaman, and now I'm making this up, I don't remember the exact details, but she had used crystals and she had used essential oils and she brought in a psychic and an animal communicator. She did all the things, you know, she did all the things that she thought a good person would do.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, she got humane traps and all this stuff, but the problem wasn't going away. And so Ken said, you know what? He goes, I like to tell you guys, when you have a problem, don't go to a Course in Miracles person to ask what to do. He said, go to somebody who's never heard of the Course in Miracles and just say, what do I do? And you know what they're going to do? They're going to take care of the problem. They're going to call the exterminator or whatever. And he said, you can do all that. He said, but, you know, your soul wanting to just do the right thing. And he goes, just be normal. Do what a normal person would do to address the problem. And, man, I thought, oh, that's me all right, you know?
Yeah, it's being normal is a good thing. Somehow that reminds me, later this evening I'm going to be on one of those late night talk radio shows about the paranormal. It's sort of the what evolved from the old Art Bell show, the midnight program. I forget the exact term, but anyway. But I was thinking, well, everybody needs to be just a normal person, or maybe a paranormal person if there's two of us, right?
Right.
Anyway, yeah, but being normal, I think, is really just about noticing what is appropriate to do in the world, do that. But at the same time, kind of like chewing gum and walking, you know, we can actually notice when we're being upset by things,
mm-hmm.
and do everything that we would do anyway, as a normal, like you say, a normal person would do, but do it without condemnation, or do it, or do it even, you know, even if we just notice the part of our mind that wants to you know, make a big deal and be upset and throw little or big tantrums or whatever magnitude, and just notice that and say, oh, wow, I must be resisting the peace that's behind this. I must want to still be in my sandbox or my prison or whatever instead of the classroom. Yeah, the other day, maybe this is a parallel we could work with, but the other day in another group we were talking about, you know, being in the sandbox, you know, and like 2-year-olds kicking sand in each other's faces, you know, and that's kind of, you know, that's the emotional maturity of everyone's ego is really never left that infantile stage, basically. We may be in older bodies, but that's, you know, the level of the ego's thinking is all about, it's all of what's in it for me, you know, the terrible twos do right. Well, yeah,
well, but, and go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say, but Holy Spirit, metaphorically, that voice with us that we took with us into the dream is sort of like an awareness that's our ground control saying, hey, you know, Captain so-and-so here, you can leave the sandbox anytime you want. You're actually you know, authorized to you know, fly your ship here, and I'll help you attain escape velocity from the guilt of a maladaptive solution to a non-existent problem here, and you can escape this prison dream as in the sandbox or whatever whenever you'd like, you know.
Well, and I've been having an interesting experience. I hope this isn't too much of an aside, but just looking at the ego, I have been so missing traveling. And like, for instance, I like to go to Hawaii at least once a year, and I haven't been able to do that. I mean, I haven't been there since 2019 because of COVID, and I'm so missing it. And so I noticed one of the channels is rerunning Hawaii 5.0. And the newer one. And the truth is, I didn't watch it the first time around because I didn't think the writing was very good. But the one thing that is incredible about it is the photography. So I found myself just like really hooked on all these reruns of Hawaii 5.0 in order to see all this Hawaiian landscaping, you know, all these pictures. But this is what's funny. I don't know if you know the show, but it is just ruthless. Perfect. It's just ruthless in terms of the evil. And, you know, the whole idea of Hawaii 5.0 is that they say that they have immunity and means. So they can pretty much do whatever they want. There are no rules for them. You know, when they bring somebody in, they don't have to read a Miranda rights. They don't, you know, they just do what they want. But this is what I've noticed is they create these really overarch enemies. I mean, overreaching. They're just like incredibly evil people. I mean, you know, they're doing human trafficking and they're doing just the worst of the worst. And one of them, you know, went over several seasons. And at first I'm kind of like, oh my God, do I have to see this guy again? He's just so terrible. Finally, after 5 seasons, they kill him. And of course, what do? They create another one. Because they have to. And that's it. You know, I was thinking that's exactly what the ego does. You can't not have a villain. You can't not have somebody that you're going to play off of, or it's going to be good against evil. It wouldn't be a popular show if they didn't have that dichotomy. So that has been really interesting to just kind of watch and realize there has to be a really evil villain in order for this to be entertaining, in order to get me to engage with it. But the other thing that kind of happened is several things. Recently with him, I will admit, he's just like, he really gets me. I mean, I'm literally going, shoot him, shoot him, shoot him, kill him, you know? And in his show recently, somebody threw him out the window. And of course, they looked down on his body. And of course, I'm saying to myself, he's not dead. You need to shoot him. You need to make sure. So, of course, when they go down, you know, several stories, he's gone. And I'm like, who? You know, we all knew that. The villain isn't going to die that easily. The other thing that happened is, like I said, I felt my ability to express that frustration and anger. Kill him, kill him, kill him. You know, which is an interesting way to see myself. But But the other thing that I noticed is I thought, and you know what happens? They shoot the scene, and then they all get up and go have coffee together or something, you know? And I thought, that's the other thing. This actor is so good that I just hate him, and yet that's it. As soon as that scene ends, they're all sitting going, hey, was that good for you? That was good for me. You know, really, let's have a Coke or let's have, you know, whatever we do. And I thought, you know, can you just kind of get into that, that no matter how angry or upset or villainous somebody seems, you know, the scene is over, and can you now just be okay, you know? We're all in this together. Can you do that? So anyway, watching Hawaii Five-O has brought out a lot of emotion, but a lot of opportunities to look at living in the world, prison or classroom.
Bingo, bingo. Yeah, that's a great example. As you were sharing that, I was thinking, you know, that the actors, you know, when they're between, you know, filming, you know, take five breaks or whatever, you know, you know, like you said, they could be laughing and smiling and imagining at the end of the production, like if it was on in a theatrical venue, you know, you could take everyone in our lives, you know, everyone that's played any role, no matter how major or minor, you know, the politicians that we hate to love and the ones we love to hate, all the family members, all the coworkers and bosses and employees and you know, it, people that cut us off in the freeway or the truck driver a month ago that decided he liked my lane better and I got off by only having my left rearview mirror bent over by the car on the other side
down
the freeway. that was an interesting, you know, opportunity to notice not only the adrenaline rush but also how quickly, compared to a decade or two ago, I realized that I was projecting. And I forgave myself for that projection, and I was very grateful that my guardian angels were saying, "Yeah, you don't need to, you know, have a big, you know, thing. This is no big deal."
Yeah.
And so you know, when I got up, there's a little ding on that left rearview mirror. You know, an hour or two later, when I got out of the car finally, and the adrenaline had long since faded, it's like,
oh my God! But yeah, that's a big deal.
But at the same time, I realized, well, is that a big deal, or is that just you know, making a big deal out of everything, which is really nothing?
You know?
And I tried to remember that. I think I was actually much better able to do that in that incident than I would have been a few years ago. I think it's because I've been really noticing the surreality of this classroom, and then which, you know, instead of, you know, I think I'm making it a little bit less of a prison all the time, and I think that's what the course is asking us to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, and when you say guardian angel, you know, that's, I think especially because of, in my line of work, you know, I get so immersed into the astrology or into, as you were talking before, the paranormal or the other things, but also just saying, but CA, that's still part of the illusion.
Yeah.
But in fact, something happened to me one day. I was feeling particularly rushed, very overwhelmed, and things just needed to go like clockwork in order for everything to work out. And I made a cup of coffee, and I'm racing around, making my bed, and feeding the dog, and doing all this stuff. And I came back to my cup of coffee and noticed, and it was a pretty big cup of coffee, it wasn't sitting level. Because when I had put it down, I had not noticed that I'd put my keys right there on the table. Mm-hmm. And literally the coffee cup was perched on the edge of the keys. And it was full, but it had not tipped over.
Uh-huh.
And I just kind of stood there looking at that going, okay, this is evidence of guardian angels. Because I cannot believe that coffee cup didn't dump all over the piece of furniture, all over the carpet, you know, and just throw a real wrench into my morning. It was just the weirdest thing, because I don't remember that really ever happening before.
Uh-huh.
You know, but it was unusual. The keys shouldn't have been there, and I wasn't paying attention. I just set the coffee cup down. But I thought, oh, how funny. But there was a part of me that said, okay, Jesus, I know that you're not in the illusion. I know that, but thank you anyway.
Yeah, and then maybe that's kind of the way that, one way that they, that may manifest, not always, but sometimes, you know, when when we realize that we're less and less interested in making big deals out of things, that we kind of, you know, have a blessed situation where we're kind of like Mr. Magoo. You know, he thinks he's walking on the ground, but he's actually on a girder that's being lifted up by a crane that's being and swinging around, and he's walking between two skyscrapers under construction, completely oblivious to the fact that he's suspended seven stories in midair, you know, walking across this girder, you know, and unbeknownst to him, you know, he leaves one building and lands on the other, and you know, not so much the wiser, you know, of what's actually happened.
Right.
Any other observer, but you know, does it make a difference? Does it make a difference what's happening in a dream? And I think that's I think what you know, the Course keeps reminding us is that how could anything that changes have an impact on our real being?
I like that example, though, because it is so true. It's like sometimes we probably have no idea what danger we've been in, you know, and we're oblivious. But on the other hand, you know, maybe sometimes we are making the right decisions and making the right choices without having to agonize over it. Just like him walking from girder to girder and not agonizing over the decision, but somehow just making the right one, you know.
Yeah, it's trust, you know. It's like, and we don't even have to know all the details, you know. Like when you throw a light switch on or off, you don't have to have a PhD in electrical engineering, you know. I mean, I've got a bachelor's in electrical engineering. I still don't know how electricity works, so yeah, there you go, right?
That's right. Great example. You know, and I love electricity as a good example of many things in terms of trust, because, you know, we don't understand how it works.
No.
We don't understand it all, but we trust it. We flip the light switch, and it's so frustrating when it doesn't work because most of us don't know why it didn't, right?
Yeah, recently we got a couple of these high-tech newfangled light bulbs at Costco and installed one in the living room, one in the back bedroom, and our cats tend to sleep on the back of the couches. And I was trying to impress one of our cats last night when I used my phone, the little app on my phone, to turn off the living room light, and he was totally unimpressed that I was able to turn the light on and off with my phone. So, you know, go figure. You know, just cats, you just can't impress cats easily.
No, you can't. You cannot. Now, but what makes it a newfangled? Is it the light bulb itself, or put it into a smart feature?
It's a smart light bulb that is connected via Bluetooth to your router and. Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, whatever, to your router.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, it's kind of cool, and you can make it actually do all kinds of colors and different brightness levels. It's pretty kind of fun, actually.
Oh, that is pretty cool. Newfangled. I love that word
too.
Yeah,
I don't use that often, but
yeah, that's really cool.
Well, should we talk about the prison classroom metaphor?
Absolutely.
I grabbed I went to chapter 3, section 7, creating versus the self-image.
Okay.
If you want to jump there, I'll just start reading this, the first paragraph.
Okay, and I don't have my books right here with me.
Oh, okay.
I'm thinking, but I can look them up on my computer really quickly. So okay. Can you tell me again where you're going? Let me first find my file of ACIM.
Okay, it's chapter 3 in the text.
Okay, hold on. ACIM. And it's the text. And it's chapter 3. Okay.
Uh-huh. And section 7. I hear that mouse wheel.
Yep, I'm going. I'm in chapter 2 right now. I'm trying to see.
I can hear it rolling.
How fast I can get to chapter 3. Okay, and it's 7.
So, creating versus the self-image.
Almost there.
Okay.
Creating versus the self-image. Got it.
Ta-da!
It's nice to have a digital copy.
Isn't it, though?
Yes.
So, the first paragraph begins, every system of thought must have a starting point. It begins with either a making or a creating. a difference we've already discussed. And then a quick aside is, you know, in the course, in A Course in Miracles, making always refers to, almost always refers to, you know, an activity of the ego mind, and creating is really, it's really kind of even beyond our right minds. It's really outside the realm of illusion. But, you know, the course reminds us that our real identity has always been creating and has never made up anything. It's the making is just something that is part of our mass hallucination we call the dream of space-time. So anyway, it goes on, their resemblance lies in their power as foundations. Their difference lies in what rests upon them. Both are cornerstones for systems of belief by which one lives. It is a mistake to believe that a thought system based on lies is weak. Nothing made by a child of God is without power. It is essential to realize this, because otherwise you will be unable to escape from the prison you have made.
Now, and did you say, I know you told me earlier that when you looked up, you know, trying to search for the word prison, you found it 60 times.
60 references.
That is amazing.
Yeah, quite a few. So I think the author is trying to suggest just perhaps that we need to look at these imaginary bars of prison walls that we made and you know, notice with the help from our inner kindness teacher, aka Holy Spirit, that not only are the bars just holographically projected, but if we look carefully, that where we thought there was a door that was locked, there's really nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, or maybe it's a door that was welded open.
Yeah, but well, I love that last. Well, it's not the last line, but nothing made by a child of God is without power.
Yeah.
It is essential to realize this, because otherwise you will be unable to escape from the prison you have made.
Yep. And then the next paragraph, if you want to read that, I think really ties into maybe in this section, but it's in early in the text where he says, you know, if I were to depreciate the power of your mind, I would be, you know, minimizing the law of cause and effect, which is the most fundamental law there is. And it's also suggesting that our minds are incredibly powerful, because we, not individually, but collectively, we made up and are all complicit in
this whole world.
This whole world as a mechanism for escaping from unconscious but unfounded guilt, which is pretty whacked out.
Amazing.
Crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay,
so I'll read it. You cannot resolve the authority problem by depreciating the power of your mind. To do so is to deceive yourself, and this will hurt you because you really understand the strength of the mind. You also realize that you cannot weaken it any more than you can weaken God. The devil, and the devil is in quotes, is a frightening concept because he seems to be extremely powerful and extremely active. He is perceived as a force in combat with God, battling him for possession of his creations. The devil deceives by lies and builds kingdoms in which everything is in direct opposition to God. Yet he attracts men rather than repels them, and they are willing to sell him their souls in return for gifts of no real worth. This makes absolutely no sense.
Uh-huh.
That's what it says. I didn't. That's not an editorial comment.
No. It really does say that, and it's just silly. I love how Ken Wapnick keeps coming back to the idea that you know, all this evil stuff that we've made up is just imaginary. It's on the level of form. Yeah, like you were talking about earlier, we need to be normal and just do the appropriate thing. Is, you know, if somebody's behaving in a antisocial manner that's harming life and limb, you know, they probably need to be in a courtroom or perhaps in a physical prison. But we're mm-hmm. talking about the mental prisons here. This is, and once again, I always try to remind myself whenever I pick up the course, it's always and only about the mind. And if that's the case, then I just need to look at where I'm the jailer and the prisoner simultaneously by choosing a thought system that limits my reality and limits everyone else's reality, because I equate my identity with everyone else's identity, and that's one of the big clues is how we maintain our prison status in the mind is by asserting that, you know, there's victims and victimizers, that there's good guys and bad guys, that there's a we and a they. As long as there's a dualistic, adversarial, confrontational, war going on of one sort or another, then prisons are filled with prisoners of war, mm-hmm. and the wars don't have to be, declared by governments. They can just be, disputes between individuals or local authorities or whatever. I mean, but it's really, metaphorically, it really doesn't matter as long as we think that there's a constraint or a limitation on our identity. We're putting ourselves in prison. But the fundamental thought system is always one of sin, guilt, fear, death, punishment, sacrifice, suffering. It's that whole gamut of stuff that is the ego's bailiwick. As long as we have a mechanism whereby we can say, I'm upset, but it's not my fault. I'm not at peace, but it's because of X, Y, and Z people or things or circumstances or the weather or the economy or the virus or the, pick your favorite.
Pick your favorite whatever.
Du jour. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And just like I was saying on that show, there has to be a villain. I mean, we're not really going to be entertained or happy if there's not a villain. And we always think, well, if only this would happen this way, then I'd be happy.
Yeah.
If only this person would be different, then I'd be happy. If only this would happen a certain way. But no, that's not really true, because it's not really the problem. We are incredibly creative in coming up with new manifestations of feeling alone, feeling separated, or whatever you want to call it. And yep. When we aren't willing to address that, we'll just come up with a better version of it.
Yeah, yeah. I somehow the way you phrased that reminds me of a book that was authored not too long ago by a notable political figure. And I was thinking, well, maybe the ego's story could be titled "It Takes a Villain."
Uh-huh. Instead of a villain. Right, it takes a villain.
Because I was kind of flashing back, because we were talking about that a few moments ago. I was flashing back to some years ago. This was a few decades ago, actually. There was a news program that was a commentary, an analysis kind of program, and it was saying, "Gee, now that the Cold War was over and the Berlin Wall had come down," they were saying, "Well, now, our government here in the United States had to come up with some internal enemies."
Yes, yes.
Because there's got to be an enemy. There's got to be, mm-hmm. Someone to go after, because, like the actors in your TV show, well, if they're nobody to go after, what are they going to do? Watch each other, play words with friends on their phones in
well,
the office?
Right, yeah, right.
All to come in? not exactly, edge of the seat drama, right?
So. Right, exactly. Yeah.
Should we pick another quote about prisons?
Uh-huh. So okay. Now where are you going to go? It may take me a while to get there.
let's see. Looks like chapter 18's got some good stuff. How about 18, section 6?
Okay, I'm going to let you go first.
Okay.
Because it's going to – I don't have a good way to
– Okay, 18, 6. And I'm going to jump to paragraph 7. So 18, 6, 7 is the three numbers there. So this one is the section called Beyond the Body, which, of course, is the kind of poster child of our mental imprisonment. This paragraph starts out, "This is the host of God that you have made," meaning the body, meaning that that made up identity, "and neither God nor his most holy son can enter an abode that harbors hate, and where you have sown the seeds of vengeance, violence, and death." That sounds like strong words, but that's really the only kinds of things that are in the ego's vocabulary.
Right.
Vengeance,
right.
Violence, death, hatred, resentment, anger, grievances of every size and shape. As long as there's something or someone to be upset about, or to get hung about, as the Beatles would say, mm-hmm. then the ego thinks, okay, my identity is preserived. I lived talk about another day of misery.
Right.
So it continues. This thing you made to serve your guilt stands between you and other minds. And if there's any, you know, if the Course had anything to say about loneliness, it would have to say it's self-inflicted, because it says over and over again that minds are joined.
Right.
So if we think we're isolated with, you know, pre or post COVID, it's because we've chosen the teacher of isolation in our mind, which is the egoic thought system, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and then right here it says that minds are joined, but you do not identify with them. You see yourself locked in a separate prison, removed and unreachable, incapable of reaching out as being reached. And then I sometimes go to the metaphor of, you know, being like a droplet in the ocean. And mm-hmm. each of us think that we're this own little separate and violet droplet that can't be, you know, with its own little, you know, castle walls or prison walls or bars or doors or whatever that keeps everything else out. And, you know, here we think we're this oxygen molecule that's, you know, in the dark in this little, you know, little sphere that keeps us isolated from the rest of the ocean. But that's all made up.
Yes.
it's just... you know, and because our minds are so powerful, we can imagine that we pulled this off.
Mm-hmm.
But the ocean doesn't have any awareness of our hallucinations, and just sees us as part of the totality, and really all of the totality of that perfect oneness. Right?
That's right.
Yeah. So I'll finish the paragraph. You see yourself locked in a separate prison, removed and unreachable, incapable of reaching out as being reached. You hate this prison you have made and would destroy it, but you would not escape from it, leaving it unharmed without your guilt upon it. Well, there's kind of like the story you're just telling about the guy thrown out the window. It's like, well, yeah, we'll destroy it, but let's make sure it still survives so it can continue to haunt us, right?
Right. Well, and you know, another, going back to Ken's living in the, you know, living in the world prisoner classroom,
right.
A lot of times, in fact, I tell the audience, sometimes I cut out the question and answer periods,
uh-huh.
you know, because I really want to hear the workshop. But ironically enough, in this particular workshop, I think some of the best material is Ken's answers. Uh-huh. To the questions that come up. And
yeah.
One woman, I resonated with her too, because she was describing that there was a wedding or something going on next to her hotel room while she was
yes.
at this workshop. And she said, but you know what I realized is how much I was enjoying being the victim. Mm-hmm. I was enjoying being angry. I needed, you know, and I, boy, I'll tell you what, that hit home, because there are times when I really just stop and realize that's what's going on. I like being angry. I like feeling like I've been victimized, and, you know, I like feeling self-righteous. And so
and
what am I without
takes a lot
it?
Of honesty to say that, doesn't it?
Yes, but it's true.
yeah. But when we can say that and not condemn ourselves, just say, wow, there's a part of me that's afraid of the loving kindness and the peace that's beyond that.
Yeah.
And that's okay, because I will eventually weary of, you know, reveling in that martyrdom, victimhood, misery, self-pity, whatever you want to call it, and say, you know, I think I've had enough of that.
Yeah, and you know, I will hear again honesty. I haven't gotten to the part where I can say that latter part. You know, that you said, like, I fear, you know, being one, or I fear the love. I, you know, I'm afraid of that. But I am at the point of going, boy, you know, I don't like this. There's got to be another way to feel.
Exactly.
And why do, you know, why is this so enjoyable to be the self-righteous one who's been wronged? Why do I, you know, why do I need that in my life when it's actually so painful? But I haven't quite got the explanation yet. I'm not over that. What did they call it? Critical mass or something like that?
Yeah.
I'm at the edge, you know, but I'm not there yet.
Well, I don't think hardly any of us are. I mean, I think that's you know, kind of toward the top of the ladder kind of thing, where we become more conscious of that more frequently. But you know, just the fact that we notice when we're not at peace, that like the rules for decision. I must have decided wrongly because I'm not at peace, and perhaps I'd benefit by admitting mm-hmm. that I'm you know, I'm wrong, and that there is a right answer that's not from me, that's, you know, that's outside my my little identity as a water droplet, and maybe the ocean has a better rebuttal here.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, just that's it. Recognizing I like being unhappy.
Yeah.
Those moments. I like it.
Yep.
Damn
it.
That
sounds crazy to say it, but when we can say that and just realize that actually in itself requires something outside the ego to provide that recognition, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Which means that we've sown the seeds of something that can take the place of that insanity.
Yes. Well, or another way of looking at it, I think for me, is recognizing I have my stories and how attached I am to the story. Mm-hmm. So, and we all do, you know, it's that somebody tells you something and you go, well, wait till you hear this one. Wait till you hear what happened to me. And there was a time when all of a sudden I realized I had my favorite stories, and some of them were 20, 30 years old. Mm-hmm. And I still want to tell them, Bruce.
I'm probably going to be doing that this evening, because it's the show that I'm doing later this evening is probably going to emphasize things that are things I've enjoyed over the years but probably haven't done much with for 10, 15, 20, maybe 30 years.
Yeah.
But that's okay. That's okay. But it's, you know, but I'm sure I'll lead it inexorably back to the non-dual metaphysics of the Course. Because I've realized that, yeah, all that other stuff is fun, but you know, ultimately, we all want to get out of the prison. We all want to escape. Even if we don't admit it to ourselves that often, there's that calling, kind of like, you know, Workbook Lesson 182. You know, there's that little voice that says, can we just go home now?
Well, yeah, you know, because, yeah, once again, sometimes when I hear myself telling a story that is that old, I'm like, what is the benefit to you to once again telling everybody what a victim you were?
Yeah.
What is the benefit to you now? Can you not? In fact, I had a friend who I used to say this about. She would tell something about me. I mean, we had known each other a very long time. And it was something from like 20, 30 years ago, like being teenagers. And it's like, you know what? We're 30 now. I'm not that person. And yet she would continue to say it. And I would kind of say, well, you know what? Yeah, I did that at 15. I'm not doing it at 35. And mm-hmm. But she loved to keep telling it. And I remember that it just felt so irritating to me, because it did almost feel like she wouldn't let me grow up.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We couldn't talk about being 30 or 40 or whatever it was. And we had to keep talking about teenage stuff. And yet that's exactly what I do to myself when I tell those stories.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm telling different ones than she, right?
Of course.
But my stories are still about, hey, guys, listen to how I have been victimized. You know, and yeah, why do we want to hang on to these labels and these stories of poor me and look what happened to me? Why do we want to keep telling them? And I mean, I think, too, I'm finally at that point of going, why do you want to keep telling that story?
Well, you know, as you're sharing this, I was thinking it's probably good that we let go of this slowly, because if everybody stopped telling their stories and stopped being interested in listening to other people's stories about victimization and martyrdom and you know, abuse and all that whole gamut of stuff, the whole, you know, communications infrastructure around the planet would suddenly drop away.
Yes.
Because there wouldn't be much traffic for anything, any kind of communication.
That's right. There'd be no Hawaii 5-0 for sure.
It would just be the guys in the office waiting for the phone to ring, and that
yes.
previous TV show you're talking about, right?
Yes, but that's it. It's like our story. You know, why? Let's change our investment in what our story is.
Right. Nobody to lock up here. I guess we'll just go back to our... the games on our phones, you know.
Yeah, let's create another story, and not just on a superficial level of, hey, I'm going to say an affirmation, but let's create a different story about, you know, even like one of that first thing we read about how powerful our minds are.
Yeah. Well, you know? Notice I did upgrade the timeliness of my metaphor by, instead of using like a crossword puzzle, or the guys sitting around, the folks sitting around the office doing crossword, now they're playing games on their phones, right?
Yeah, so that's right.
I'm trying to be up to date.
Thank you for doing that. Yes, thank you. Well, did you have one more excerpt you wanted to, or not excerpt, but
well,
one
actually,
more?
Well, actually, Well, the next paragraph, mentions that as well. If you're there, you could read it, or I could read
now,
it.
Now, does it start, yet only thus can you escape?
That's the one.
Okay,
that's
all right. Yeah. Yet only thus can you escape. The home of vengeance is not yours. The place you set aside to house your hate is not a prison, but an illusion of yourself. The body is a limit imposed on the universal communication that is an eternal property of the mind. But the communication is internal. Mind reaches to itself. It is not made up of different parts which reach out to each other. It does not go out. Within itself, it has no limits, and there is nothing outside it. It encompasses everything. It encompasses you entirely. You within it, and it within you. There is nothing else, anywhere, or ever.
That's pretty staggering, isn't
it? It is. Where'd you get this stuff, Bruce?
well, it's one of those paragraphs that's like, was that in there before? You know?
That's what I was thinking.
Realizing that you know, most of my day is spent in some form of communication, you know, on a computer or phone or something, and it's like, I just realized like, it's never outside. It's never with another, in truth, it's always in my mind. And that's something that I don't think we're asked to just suddenly, you know, say, oh, sure, of course. You know, I think it's something we kind of gradually ease into, like so much of the, you know, the pure non-dual metaphysics of the Course.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's really comforting to realize that all the problems that we think are due to, you know, differences and duality and you know, the conflict that seems to be part and parcel of the world, are made up.
Yeah.
They're illusions, hallucinations, dreams, movies, pick your metaphor du jour.
And, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also kind of remind a bit of, you know, recent technology where they have these things called qubits or quantum bits in quantum computing systems that are just in their early infancy in places like IBM and you know, some of these, you know, research labs that are spending, you know, megabucks doing things that will ultimately revolutionize our technology in ways we can't even imagine. But they already have these things called, if we talked about this before, I'll keep it short, but they have these things called qubits that they can synchronize one qubit to another, and the command that the software uses to do this is called teleport. Star Trek fans.
Yeah, I was going to say, like Star Trek?
But what it does is a normal bit in a computer or in your laptop or your phone or whatever, any electronic digital device, it has a one or a zero state, right? Well, there's actually a third state, which is like an indeterminate state in a qubit. But it's that it's basically, without getting into the physics, which I don't even begin to understand the ramifications of it, let alone any of the deep, you know, theory behind it. But the gist of it is you can actually synchronize these two qubits so that they're in the same state all the time for brief periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you change the state of one, the other qubit that's synchronized will instantaneously change its state, not at the speed of light, 10 times the speed of light, a gazillion times the speed of light, instantaneously. So that is pretty staggering. That's basically, you know, using a practical example of what's called quantum entanglement to make a device that can literally talk. Whether you could have one qubit that's in a submarine at the bottom of the ocean and another qubit that's in a lead box on some planet orbiting some solar system in the, you know, Andromeda galaxy, and those qubits, if they were synchronized, they would translate, you know, transfer, quote unquote, that information simultaneously. No concern about how far apart the two devices were, and they would be exactly the same state, which is, you know,
amazing.
Basically says space and time are,
it's an illusion.
They're misunderstandings.
Yeah.
So we've got everything inside it. So this last paragraph we read really is kind of indicative of the craziness of the prison we've made of space and time, and specifically our bodies, which are the poster children of those prisons.
That's right.
In fact, one of the ways that the Course describes the body is it's a rotting prison, which is not a terribly flattering description, is it?
No, it's not. And on that note, Bruce, we have about 5 minutes to wrap up our show today. So let's not wrap it up on the rotting prison of the body.
Yeah, let's cheer it up a little bit.
I want to hear something else.
Okay. Well, let's go to the I did find one instance of the word classroom, since we were talking about prisons and classrooms.
Okay.
Why don't I read that paragraph?
Okay, that sounds good.
That's back in Chapter 2, Section 2, Paragraph 5. And we're just kind of randomly jumping, somewhat quasi-randomly jumping around to instances of prison and classroom. I think we mentioned there were 60 instances of prison, but only one of classroom. So here's the one instance of classroom in A Course in Miracles.
Okay.
And paragraph 5 begins, "The atonement was built into the space-time belief to set a limit on the need for the belief itself." Ah, we got an escape clause.
Oh, yeah, that sounds great.
And ultimately to make learning complete. The atonement is the final lesson. Learning itself, like the classrooms in which it occurs, is temporary. The ability to learn has no value when change is no longer necessary. The eternally creative have nothing to learn. You can learn to improve your perceptions and can become a better and better learner. This will bring you into closer and closer accord with the sonship. But the sonship itself is a perfect creation, and perfection is not a matter of degree. Only while there is belief in differences is learning meaningful. So that perfection is really the state of mind that we were in before the announcement came over the radio that says, this war of worlds is just a simulation. It's just a dramatic show. You know, don't take it seriously.
Yes, that's right. Don't take it seriously.
All right.
Well, before we close the show today, I just want to say thank you so much, Bruce. It's been wonderful getting back together with you.
Yeah.
And do you have any announcements that you'd like to make before we close?
Well, I'm always posting stuff on ACIMblog.com, and I always encourage people to go to three other websites as well, which is they're easy to remember because they all end in ACIM.org. The first being the Foundation for Inner Peace website, or FIP. Their website is just acim.org. The next one is the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, which is facim.org. And those first two are the sister organizations that really have made A Course in Miracles what it is over many decades now. And kudos to all those people who have diligently put forth both the teaching as well as the materials to make the course available for so many people, millions of people around the planet.
Oh, yeah.
And then the last one is Tim Wise and Lynn Corona's organization, very informal, the School for A Course in Miracles. They have classes almost daily. I think Friday is the only day of the week that they're currently not teaching classes. And I try to attend as many as I can. In fact, I'll be attending one in about an hour and a half from now. And they're all online, and you can go to sfacim.org for that website.
So, okay. And everybody, you can find Bruce at www.acimblog.com, correct?
Yes, yes.
Okay,
don't forget that one.
Www,
that's even these days, yeah.
Oh, well, you know, you're better at the technology than me, so thank you very much for that.
We're all learning together.
Okay. Well, Bruce, thank you so much
likewise,
being here. And to all the listeners, thank you for joining us today. I hope you've enjoyed this conversation and discussion. And thanks to our producer, Scott Weaver. Remember that you can always find me for readings, personal consultations, mentoring, and coaching on 12listen.com. And I hope that you will join me on Tuesdays for my other show where we talk about the illusion astrology. So until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. You have been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks and my very special guest, Bruce Rawls, on 12 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality and qubits.